The Magazine Review. Share Radio's look through the weekend business press.
Yes, it's that time of the show when we take a look at some of the stories dominating the pages of the country's leading business magazines. We are joined in the studio by Tom Follett, Senior Policy Officer, Thomas Nguyen, Policy Researcher on Industrial Strategy. They're both from ResPublica. And Sophie Gaston is Head of International Projects and External Affairs at Demos. Welcome to all of you. Now, in this first section, we are going to be talking about Trump, looking at different aspects that magazines have picked up on this. But we're going to start by looking at an article from The Economist, a Trump White House, and it's asking what Donald Trump is likely to achieve in power. Who wants to kick off? This is all obviously incredibly speculative because we don't really know one minute to the other, and as many people point out, sometimes we're not sure he knows.
Well, that's right. I mean, we really aren't sure what a Trump White House is going to look like at this point. We've been given assurances that we should take what Trump says seriously, but not literally. Of course, the most consistent predictor for what presidential candidates actually do is what they pledge in the campaign. But what did Trump pledge? It's very hard to pin that down. One minute he says he's going to repeal the Paris Climate Change Agreement. The next he says that he's yet to be convinced. He says he's going to repeal Obamacare. He says he's going to replace it with insurance that will work for everyone. So it's very hard to tell. What we do know is that a Trump White House will continue the adversarial style of his campaign, using Twitter as a bully pulpit, often to great effect, at least from his perspective, persuading the car manufacturers to not invest in more production capacity in Mexico, but to do that in the US. His tweets, he tweeted about the F-35 military jet, and Boeing had a huge amount wiped off their share price. So he's what we do know is that he'll run his White House as he ran his campaign. But in terms of policy, it looks like he's going to leave that to his appointees, which are themselves a very mixed bag.
Yes. And the article starts by quoting British academic David Runciman, saying that politics matter little to most people for most of the time. Then suddenly it all matters all too much. So, Sophie, are we going through a time when politics suddenly actually is quite important?
Yes, absolutely. And I think what we're seeing is that over recent decades, we've definitely had this sort of division between economic policy, social policy, et cetera, and politics has sort of floated in around the middle of that. We've seen social and cultural crises now starting to have serious political consequences. And of course, there is an economic dimension as well. So we're starting to see everything coming together and conflating. I think this is why we've got this sense of crisis at the moment. I think this piece is interesting because what it's saying really is that that there is an element to us saying that we don't know what Trump will be like in power that reflects our own denial of just how dangerous he will probably be. There is this hope that a Republican administration will ultimately rein him in, that the checks and balances that are in place in the American system of government will prevent him from being too much of a maverick, as we saw him in the as we saw him in the campaign. But this article is suggesting that we need to that we are perhaps in a state of denial and need to accept that we do actually know some things about him, and that they do allude to the fact that he may be quite dangerous.
And yet, Thomas, we have to accept that there will be large areas of America that will be absolutely overjoyed that he's become the new president. While he met up with a person that sort of was in a standard sort of liberal thinkers, the members of the establishment would necessarily want as president. Clearly, in the Rust Belt and many other areas, he is incredibly popular.
Yeah, I think that's true. It certainly is a huge factor that's been, you know, a massive driving force behind his campaign. However, it also has to be remembered that his popularity ratings are unprecedented in terms of how low they are. You know, we're seeing stats of 40% popularity. It's totally unprecedented. And that, you know, just pays testament to the divide that is currently ongoing in the US. In terms of when we say, you know, OK, uncertainty is perhaps the most predictable thing about his what his presidency will look like, we do have some clues to kind of tell us in terms of the the choices that he's made in selecting his candidates for office. We kind of have a clue on the direction that their agenda will take. We also know Trump's personality from, you know, he's extremely public in his tweets. We almost have an inside window into his character and his personality. So there's definitely a lot of evidence that we can collect to kind of figure out a direction of travel for the
He seems to be a sort of WYSIWYG president. There was a sitcom years ago in which one of the characters was basically the brain of the person. You can't help feeling we are getting straight from the brain to the keypad in many cases. The second Economist piece we're going to look at in this section is a hell of a handover, which is talking about Trump's appointments. Thomas referred to those. So, Tom, let's move to you. Which of the appointments do you think are most interesting? We certainly know that we've got the whitest and most male cabinet for some time in America.
Absolutely. I mean, looking at his appointments, you can sort of break it down into three categories. You've got the kind of real no-hopers. So you've got Tom Price. He's a doctor from Georgia, a former congressman. He's the pick for health secretary, and he's already troubled by a scandal over legislation that would have benefited a medical kit firm which he owned. And you've got Betsy DeVos as well. She was proposed for education secretary. In the Senate hearings, it came out that she didn't really understand the difference between measuring increases in attainment in schools and measuring sort of absolute test scores, which is a very important divide in education policy. Then you've got your kind of traditional bankers, businessmen, sort of your typical Republican fare, two Goldman Sachs alumni, Stephen Mnuchin and Gary Cohn. And then you've got the kind of people who are in Mr. Trump's court, Steve Bannon, Jared Kushner, his 36-year-old son-in-law. So you can see them sort of start breaking down as the ones that will be runners and riders.
Sophie, what strikes you about them? I was particularly interested in this article in The Economist about a comment from somebody in Trump's camp saying that he's very aesthetic, that if doesn't matter how good you're doing the job, if you don't look the part, the chances are Trump is not going to choose you. But that may actually be true of politicians around the world.
Yes, I mean, I think that what is clear here is that he has an agenda, whether that's based around his own personal interests or ideologies, that is running roughshod over caliber. And also, again, as you say, this sort of aesthetic consciousness of the strong man appeal, which is something that we're seeing right across the world, actually. This is not a unique phenomenon. In many ways, it is this sort of sense that Putin is the model for this. He is the authoritarian strong man. He's wrestling with bears, etc., etc. And I think that Trump likes the idea of being surrounded by this. It's almost like having his own sort of personal army around him. I think this piece is very interesting because, of course, it's focusing on the nuts and bolts of the administration who'll be coming in and starting to unpick what these picks, these choices might actually mean in terms of the policy making that we'll see under Trump's leadership. So I think we had a campaign that was very focused on personalities. It was Trump and it was Clinton. What was less discussed during the whole campaign was the type of administration they would be bringing in underneath them. Yes. And certainly we have ended up here under Trump with an arch-conservative Republican administration. And I think the fact that Trump himself is such a wild card and was so difficult to pin down into different ideological categories perhaps masked that. And there wasn't as much discussion about what that would actually mean with him presiding over this and the sorts of issues that would suddenly be on the agenda again. And we're talking here about, you know, women's and reproductive rights and racial equality issues and a lot of debates that actually had felt settled in the US and now again up at stake.
Thomas, Trump has said that he's perfectly happy for the members of his cabinet and his team to disagree with him. We've already had one or two instances of them saying things that ran slightly counter to what Trump said. But Trump doesn't take criticism very well, does he? Do you think that that's right? I mean, there are a lot of very strong personalities, and not all of them necessarily will hold the same views as Trump on everything.
No, you're absolutely right. I think what is clear that is that just the degree to which his cabinet are split on particular issues, such as, you know, the Republicans' incoming reform on tax. We've had a couple of his nominees for the National Security Council saying that they won't necessarily heed everything that Trump says in regards CIA operations. So a lot of pretty fundamental disagreements that are coming out. And we also have no idea whether he will allow them to play out the different contests within the cabinet, and whether he'll decide to side with one camp or another. So, again, many key policy issues. Take, for instance, foreign policy, where the nominee for State Secretary has said that that NATO is something that needs to be bolstered. You know, that directly is in contrast to what Trump has said about NATO. So I think, you know, there needs to be, as they go into cabinet, there needs to be a more clear and coherent kind of agenda for where what they will present to the public.
The article also asked the question of whether Trump's going to govern in the same way as he ran The Apprentice, which it describes as a squabbling talking shop over which Mr. Trump presides watchfully before swooping down on one side of an argument or another. And that's also how he manages business, so that's perhaps how he'll run his cabinet.
Yes, we will come back in just a moment. Where perhaps we should discuss whether or not many commentators are right in that it could be quite dangerous, sort of imagining that you're going to be conducting, running the United States in the same way as you might be doing a business deal. But we'll take a quick break. We'll be back very soon.
The Magazine Review. Share Radio's look through the weekend business press.
I'm here with three guests: Sophie Gaston, head of international projects and external affairs at Demos, and two from ResPublica: Tom Follett, who's senior policy officer,
hello,
and Thomas Newen, who's the policy researcher on industrial strategy. We're going to have a look now at an article from Money Week, which is headlined "Can Trump Really Make America Great Again?" It's written by Rupert Foster. Now, it does say, Sophie, right at the top, it says the average American household hasn't had a pay rise since 1999. And it says, and presumably quite correctly, this statistic explains Donald Trump's election victory more than any other. This is the squeezed middle, and indeed the squeezed lower, who just feel somehow everybody else has had the benefits that should somehow have been accruing to them as well.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think if we want to look at the economic aspect, there's so many things at play here in Trump's victory, and it's something that we're seeing right across the West, and that is really playing into the hands of the rise of populism at the moment. And this is this sense of really decades-long trends in terms of changing structures of the labour market taking hold, but coupled with this very cataclysmic shock that was the global financial crisis. And it really is important to remember that many countries, and particularly in Europe actually as well, really have never fully recovered from that. And in places like the US and the UK, a lot of the jobs growth since then has been in more precarious industries. So there is a lot of economic insecurity that is underpinning as well these social and cultural crises. I think Trump, you know, he put all his cards on the table in his campaign. He was going to make America great again by creating jobs, and he was very explicit about that. The thing to note about the context here is that actually Obama is really leaving the country in a much better place than he found it. And we've just seen record growth in jobs and a pretty positive-looking economy there. So Trump is fortunate. He is inheriting a pretty good balance sheet in that respect. But what we're going to see here and what we're seeing in this article is a push for lower corporate tax rates, but also higher import taxes. And this is where Trump's kind of deregulation free marketeer meets his protectionism. It's quite a strange mix of sort of 90s neoliberalism and sort of 70s and 80s yes. protectionism. It's quite anachronistic in that respect. But he really has to deliver quickly on jobs. But there are real contradictions with doing those two levers at the same time. He's going to have to reconcile with the interests in his cabinet, who obviously many of whom are in big business themselves and have their own personal financial interests. The key thing here is that it's good that strategy is good for domestically based businesses, but for any which have international supply chains, and we're talking about companies like Apple here, for example, or those that draw on manufacturing in China, they're going to be really taking a hit. So there is a question here as to whether or not these two strategies of deregulation and free markets mixed with hyper-protectionism, yes. whether he can get the balance right, or they'll actually just counterbalance themselves, or even worse, you get the worst of both worlds.
But Thomas, you would normally expect somebody to have such interesting economic views as Donald Trump, to have some sort of economic guru behind him, but there isn't one, is there? I mean, I haven't yet come across an economist who says Donald Trump's got all this right. It just seemed to come from his own head, don't they? All his ideas, as far as we know.
It does appear to look like that sometimes, I have to say. From his National Economic Council, there is, I think, the one academic is Peter Navarro, who, as one of the articles we've discussed today, is literally an academic who has railed against China on tariff barriers and, you know, proposes something of akin to a trade war with a lot of America's key trading partners. So it does seem sometimes that he is making economic policy on the hoof. But there are definitely two perceivable strands here, that whether the protectionist kind of America where we increase import tariffs, whether that will take shape, or whether, you know, all these promises towards the US middle class to make, you know, almost the middle class great again, whether he has to balance these two together will be really difficult and really interesting to see.
Mm. And in terms of rhetoric, they're harking back to the 1980s, an era of tax cuts, of deregulation. And the article also points out the kind of tax cuts he's talking about, reducing the top rate from 39 to 33%, is really not that radical when you consider yes. that in Reagan's time, the top rate was 70%. Also, in Reagan's time, of course, it was a time of huge technological innovation, largely funded through military expenditure and dramatic change in the economy. And that's really not where the American economy is at the moment.
Yes. But and the article points out as well, of course, that because it is trying to say, it's from Money Week, so they're trying to talk about what is going to happen from an investor's point of view, saying they reckon for the first half of the year, at any rate, the market may continue going. But at some stage, they feel inflation is going to be stoked up, bond yields are going to rise, and then suddenly the issue of debt is going to come back again, because it is the case that corporate and household America, and indeed the state itself, do still have massive debts. And if they become more expensive to service, then he's going to run into problems.
Well, I mean, I think this is not just an economic issue. This is a political and a social issue as well, because, you know, he's run a whole campaign telling people that they don't need to adjust to changes that are taking place in the global economy, that they don't need to adjust to social liberalism, for example, that they can stay living as they want to in an era that is obviously being challenged in many ways by forces bigger than America. It's this lack of discussion about the trade-offs that is so troubling. And I think there is a genuine question about, you know, when these coal mines in Pennsylvania, for example, aren't suddenly profitable and creating thousands and thousands of jobs. What, you know, is there a revolt in the street? Where do these people go?
Well, let us move on to the last article we're going to look in this half hour, which is from The Economist. It's headlined A Shift to the Right, and it talks about the European Parliament's new President. Now, I confess, Tom, we'll leave this with you. I did not know they got a new president. Martin Schulz clearly has finished his 2.5-year term as president. I think it may even be less than that. Tell us what's significant about this. In theory, it's a shift to the right.
Yes, I think the inauguration of Antonio Tajani, a centre-right Italian MP, will be somewhat less noted than another president taking place at this moment. But nonetheless, it's a significant moment for the European Parliament. It marks a transition from the sort of grand coalition of the Social Democrats and the European People's Party into the three-way coalition of the Liberals in the European Parliament, the European People's Party, which are Conservatives, and the Reformists, which are the sort of Eurosceptic, led by the UK Conservative Party. So it marks it's significant because it's one of the few real elections for president that's been competitive in the European Parliament. There were 7 candidates, a lot of them were from the fringes, admittedly, but usually it's sort of a stitch up by the big two parties. So it is significant. And the other significant thing is that the European Parliament at the moment, despite its reputation for sort of bland technocracy, almost 1/3 of the Parliament's seats, the article points out, went to anti-EU or anti-establishment outfits. So if the European Parliament thinks it's immune from the populist wave sweeping across Europe, you know, if those numbers increase following the French elections and the German elections, then the technocracy controlling the European Parliament might not be in place for too much longer.
Sophie, we tend to think of Parliament as being like our own system, but the European Parliament is more of an amending chamber, isn't it? I don't think it proposes any actual legislation. So how important do we think this is?
This is very important because they are sort of, on one level, a spokesperson for the European Union more broadly and for the Parliament itself, which is very involved in formulating and passing legislation. There is a lot at stake, actually, in this term. So obviously we have the Brexit negotiations, but we also have a whole host of other things on the agenda and big ticket things. I think what I want to say about this is that is very important in Europe is that this reflects the pact between the centre-left and the centre-right collapsing. And again, we see the centre-right sort of digging its heels in here. And this is a trend we're seeing right across Europe. So it was meant to be a joint process of government. But we've seen the centre-left and centre-right butting heads, and the centre-right coming out victorious here. So it is a change of the guard here, and that is important to note, that slight balance of power shifting as well in Europe.
And it raises the question of what happens to the European left, which is...
Well, it's going to be an interesting year for the European Union with so many elections in so many places. Thank you very much indeed to our guests. They will be back the other side of the news, where we will be looking at Brexit. That's Sophie Gaston, Head of International Projects and External Affairs at Demos, Thomas Nguyen, who is Policy Researcher on Industrial Strategy at ResPublica, and Tom Follett, who's Senior Policy Officer at ResPublica. We'll be back with more of the magazine review, the other side of the news, where we'll be looking at a couple of articles about Brexit.
The Magazine Review. Share Radio's look through the weekend business press.
Now, we're looking at some of the top stories in the pages of the country's leading business magazines. With me in the studio, Sophie Gaston, Head of International Projects and External Affairs at Demos, and from ResPublica, Tom Follett, who's the Senior Policy Officer, and Thomas Nguyen, who is the Policy Researcher on Industrial Strategy. So in this section of the programme, for about 50 minutes or so, we're going to be discussing Brexit. How can you possibly get through it without talking about that? And we're going to be looking at two pieces from The Economist, what Brexit really means, and from Money Week, a piece headed Talk Global, Act Local. So let's start perhaps with you, Thomas, and look at this, What Brexit Really Means, which is written by, actually this is from Money Week. I'm sorry, I have these pieces around entirely the wrong way. This is from Money Week, and it's Merin Somerset Webb talking about what Brexit really means.
Yeah, so I think that it's clear that Theresa May's speech earlier this week has been, you know, it's been expected for a long time, and it's really good for companies that we now have some clarity from government on the exact terms that the government would look for in negotiations. What has been lauded around the press a lot has been the rise in pound sterling, that suggests that this offers, that the government is offering some kind of confidence and stability to businesses. But I think it's also important that we remember that much of the what has been promised has not yet actually been seen in detail. It hasn't actually been enacted yet. We still have a couple of years before we're able to see exactly how this plays out. For instance, a lot of the talk around securing free trade deals within 2 to 3 years just sounds not feasible in any way. If you think about America's Pacific trade deal that has taken well over 8 years, you know, as one of the world's biggest trading partners, you know, that suggests to me that there are a lot of obstacles to securing free trade deals that haven't really been accounted for. When we think of when free trade deals are discussed, it's usually you hear New Zealand and Norway mentioned as possible trading partners, but I think it's also important that we consider exactly what is the nature of these kind of deals, that in what ways would the UK benefit from these kind of deals. So certainly useful in terms of clarity, but no hard concrete policies yet.
I think we can probably just discuss these two pieces together, both the Economist piece, Talk Global Act Local, subhead is Doing Brexit the Hard Way, and the Merin Somerset piece from Money Week, What Brexit Really Means. Sophie, what's your take on these? I mean, one clearly is sort of implying that it's all going to be jolly easy, and the other is explaining that it's going to be really incredibly difficult.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a few sort of false truths in the Money Week piece here. I mean, even this line, you know, we talking about our leverage, that we can simply walk away at the end of 2019 if needs be. I mean, I think this is really playing into these false narratives here.
And that's May's comment, sort of better no deal than a bad deal.
Well, I mean, I think we all know that it would be catastrophic for many of our most important profitable industries to fall off this cliff edge, as we say. The other practical reality of it all is that we have a pretty sizable bill in the realm of about £60 billion that we owe the EU, whether we walk away or not. So I think the Money Week piece, I think, you know, just is possibly erring on slightly on the side of fiction in that respect. But I think that the piece in The Economist is important because it marks this distinction and that May, you know, it suggests that May is a bit of an enigma and a contradiction. I think she is something that we haven't seen very much of recently, and this is that she is someone who is global but not liberal. She's also not open. And I think what we're seeing in this piece and what we saw in her speech is this distinction between these three different positions. We've come to know through Blair, through Brown, through Cameron, through Clegg, who all of our leaders over the past 20 years have been liberal, open cosmopolitans. May has indicated that she is still very much for us being a global nation, but her instincts are much more authoritarian, they are more parochial. And here we're starting to see this come out.
I think it was quite extraordinary in the Money Week piece, which is by Merin Somerset Webb, and he says, we'll have 2 years to prepare for life outside the single market. I don't suppose we'll need that much time, but work expands to fit the time available. Given, you know, the number of trade deals we have to negotiate, this is just unbelievable. But the Economist piece, it highlights some interesting things. So it highlights sort of May's vision, as she put forward in her speech at Lancaster House, of a global Britain, you know, a global engaged Britain. And unfortunately, this vision for a global Britain is kind of fundamentally incompatible with the kind of Brexit that a lot of Leave voters voted for and a lot of May voters voted for. A global Britain, which realistically would mean very generous visa arrangements with Commonwealth partners like India and Canada. You know, when May went to India to speak to the Prime Minister Modi, she had the cold shoulder because she couldn't offer any assurances on visas because of her manifesto commitments. So if we want to have a global Britain, then we're going to need to start reconciling that with what May's promised to the Leave voters. The Economist article also highlights a recent poll for YouGov, and that was saying that even among Leave voters, they wouldn't be prepared to make a trade-off between wealth and immigration, which sort of highlights that immigration was sold into the debate as a sort of proxy for wealth and prosperity and jobs. And if you frame them on separate sides of the issue, then even Leave voters say, well, what I'm really talking about here is prosperity. And if I have to sacrifice prosperity and wages for the sake of cutting immigration, I'm not prepared to do that.
Sophie, we've been through 6 months of uncertainty after the actual referendum vote. The Lancaster House speech, I guess, was trying to bring some sort of certainty to what is going to happen. I mean, are we any more certain than we were before?
I think we are definitely certain about some of the clear lines. Obviously, the fact that we will not be pursuing the single market, the fact that we will be pulling out of the ECJ, the fact that we will be looking to take 100% total control over immigration. I think we do have a sense of what the stage will be for the negotiations. I think there are definite questions as to whether or not the Prime Minister perhaps had to be so certain, so fundamental and vehement around areas such as the single market. But I think giving the certainty at least allows businesses in particular to start to plan. The outcome of that might not necessarily be positive for the UK. And I think, you know, there has been a lot of conversations over the past six, 7 months since the vote about whether all businesses will be staying here in the UK or some might be looking to shift their operations elsewhere. There have been conversations. There's been preliminary planning. Now, at least they can start moving forward, knowing, having a bit of a better sense of what Britain after 2019 might to start to look like. So I think we do have some clarity. But again, we are just at the start of a negotiation period. So we know what's going to be on the table, but we don't know what we're taking off the table.
Reading these pieces, then presumably you felt that the Economist, Thomas, was rather more realistic than Merrin Somerset Webb.
Yeah, I think so. I think what sticks out, Tom, you mentioned the dilemma that May has in terms of what voter expectations might be, but also May faces a dilemma on the business side. There are, in promising that we will be out of the single market, already key industry sectors have looked to kind of promote the fact that they would consider shifting parts of their business elsewhere, where it would be more easy to continue trade within the customs union and within the single market. So, for instance, you already hear of Britain's enormous financial services, some of their largest banks considering, you know, carrying out due diligence operations in Frankfurt and Paris. And that should be a fear for May's government as well, with the promise to bail out and to support certain sectors, say Nissan, we've seen in the press, then it's perfectly reasonable that other industries will be asking themselves the question, why should we not also have more traction with government? Why should we also not have something in the way of an incentive to stay in the UK? So certainly a further dilemma on that side as well.
Just time for another couple of brief comments from both of you, Tom. Yeah, Sophie, if you'd like.
The other notable thing was May's walkaway threat in the Lancaster House speech, where she said, if we don't get the deal we want, we're prepared to walk away, we're prepared to cut our taxes, become a sort of offshore tax haven, you know, with low regulation, low tax. And the Economist article quotes somebody from JP Morgan pointing out this how much of a dangerous line this is. Reverting to WTO terms of trade, which was what that would imply, and also engaging in tax competition when at the same time we have Trump promising, you know, perhaps 15% corporate tax cut in the US. This is not a route to a productive economy. It's a route to a Britain that has less to spend.
Sophie, we're almost out of time. Any last comment?
I think something that we haven't seen yet and we can expect to hear a lot more of over the coming years are questions from the business side about what the Prime Minister will be doing to actually shield businesses here from some of the negative impacts of us leaving the European Union. I think we will obviously start to hear more requesting government intervention or sort of sweetening of tax arrangements more on a local level or a case-by-case basis. The question is whether there is more sectoral intervention. So I think that's something that we'll see more of. Again, as with the situation with Trump, we in a strange way see people voting to take down the establishment, but asking for a bigger, more involved government.
Well, thank you very much indeed to my guests. I've been in the studio with Tom Follett, Senior Policy Officer, and Thomas Nguyen, Policy Researcher on Industrial Strategy. They're both from ResPublica.
And
Sophie Gaston, Head of International Projects and External Affairs at Demos. Thank you to all of you. Very soon, I'm going to be talking to Claire Barrett, the Personal Finance Editor of FT Weekend Money. At 5 o'clock, it will be Market Wrap with Ed Bauscher. But do keep listening to Share Radio at 5.30. We'll be crossing to Donald Trump's inauguration, where Colin Bloom is our reporter on the ground.
The Magazine Review. Share Radio's look through the weekend business press.